Okay, this is our fifth class in the, what we're calling the Lights of Musar series, studying some of the works from the great, what are called the Chachmei HaMusar. And I think the more you study from their works, you come to realize that what this really is are just insights into Agada. People tend to associate Musar with some kind of very intense repetition of mantras and austere behaviors. That, to some degree, may have been true, but the Musar teachers were giving classes in understanding the Agadic sections of the Torah. That's all it is. Personally, one applies that. There were different and differing intensity levels of how people did that. But basically, the writings of the Balei HaMusar are really just shiurim in Agada and how to understand Agadic concepts. Whereas halacha can sometimes be merely technical, although really halacha shouldn't be either, but where there it's a lot more, you just have to work it out intellectually. The agadic sections of the Torah are meant to resonate in the heart. There's certain things that are hard. It's not just following the logic of something, it's understanding it and relating to it, and that's why it's agada is musar as well.
Could I ask you?
Yes.
I guess the dumb question. If you could sort of define Agada, I have a sort of vague idea of what it may be, but...
Yeah, the word is used nowadays to mean legend. Nowadays, in modern Ivrit, it's used to mean legend. In the usage, when we're talking about the two sections of the Torah, we talk about halacha versus agada. Agada would basically be anything that's not halachic.
So it's not the narrative.
Doesn't have to be narrative, right. Sometimes we mean... Well, sometimes when they talk about an agadic story in the Gemara, it means a story, but it really means all of the Torah that's not halachic. If I'm learning how to build a sukkah with all of the lumdas and all the time, that's halachic. If I'm learning anything about the clouds of glory versus the huts the Jews were in, and basically anything that's non-halachic, we end up calling agada, which is why...
So it's a very big umbrella.
Yeah, very big umbrella.
Is it always based on something that's written?
Well, it can be Medrash, it can be Gemara. We would include how we understand the narratives in the Chumash as Agada also, but it's a term, I mean, this is really a semantic matter, but it's just a term used for all of the non-halachic sections of the Torah. Very interesting thing, once we're on the subject, I gave a number of shiurim of this on Shavuos. We typically consider halacha and agada to be separate systems, and you're not supposed to mix them. In fact, there were great Rosh Yeshiva who would give a big shiur where they would first do a halachic section, and that works with one set of principles, and then they would do an agadic section that works with other principles, and if you start mixing the two, you know, it's a little bit like combining poetry and math. Like, you're not supposed to, it's a bad mashal, but you're not supposed to mix the two. Rav Kook has a fascinating concept that he holds that's only in the Talmud Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, but in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which has its source obviously in Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael, he holds the antecedent of halacha and agada. Agada really stems from nevuah, prophecy, and prophecy only existed in the land of Israel. So he writes about this in numerous places, and he holds of this very strongly, and he has proofs to it, that in the Talmud Yerushalmi, the influence of prophecy on halacha, and therefore the combination of halacha and agada, is much tighter, rather than making them two separate systems. But in classic usage, the way the Torah is studied today, halacha is one system, agada is another system. And we actually had a quote from Rav Kook in the last Sefer we learned, where he says, Agada is actually much harder than any other science, secular or religious, because in any other field, if you use a term, you know what it is. If you think you know what it means, you know what it means. If you think I understand gravity, you understand gravity. If I think I understand what the law of Mukta on Shabbos is, and I learn the test, so I know it. But in Agada, you can talk about, and he said it really in Musar, love of Hashem, fear of Hashem, different concepts. One can use all the words and not really understand it. There's sort of a meaning behind it, which is why you'll find in the writings of the Balei Musar, sometimes like Rabbi Yisrael Salanta would say something and his students would be so taken by it. And we look at, we're trying to figure, what did he say? What did he say? Because it's something that sort of has to click in the heart. There are many Hasidic stories like that too. So Agada is deeper. It's not just intellectual, it's emotional too, but it's what flushes out the full picture of the Torah. Yeah.
I have a question on the last class. I heard you mentioned Rabbi Schwab came out with an idea.
Oh, that, yeah.
And I wondered, I know he retracted it, but I wondered if that was so, what year would be in, I mean, how close would we be, how much, what year would it be to?
It'd be 165 years ahead of where we are.
So where, how many years do we have left?
Math is not my field, but 57, 73 plus 165 would put us a lot closer to 6,000.
Right.
I had forgotten that I mentioned that. Okay. Yeah, I mentioned Rav Schwab in 1962, I think it was, had written an article. There's a discrepancy between classic secular historiography and our Kabbalah from the Seder Olam. Most assume that we have to assume that there's some mistake in the secular history, or that it wasn't based on solid history, really. It was based on legends and so on. But he actually had a theory that Chazal deliberately hid 165 years to make us not become complacent that we're closer to the redemption. This is already deep into Agada. But I don't even remember that came up as a by the way.
Okay.
Let's just, I want to try to get to, especially because we missed last week, and these are Shiurim on Purim, which this is our last class before Purim. So in the sheets that I gave out, we're on page Ayin Vav. This is the Das Chochma Musar, write-ups of Musar sermons given by Rav Yerucham Levavitz of Mir, the great Mashgiach of the Mir Yeshiva. And this was delivered on Purim itself, the eve of Purim, in the year 1934, 1935, which, by the way, is relevant if you see the nature of what he's talking about. Knowing that it's in 1934, 1935, it gives an added dimension to it. This piece, for those who have the page before it, Ayin Hey, you might not have it if you don't have the full photocopy. We started to read it last time. He's talking about what was, they gave the title to the talk, The Secret of the Hatred Toward the Jewish People, which is really the hatred of evil to good. I'm going to have to paraphrase a little bit because we're not going to have time to read through the whole mimer, but the idea that he's trying to bring out is that the Megillah is not just a story of what happened, which I think should be obvious to all of us. There certainly are many deeper levels of meaning of the Megillah. I have to speak about some of them on Shabbos. But he means even at a pshat level, without finding allusions to deeper things, and that without reading it at the realm of remez and sod, even reading it as pshat, the Megillah is not really just a story about Haman and Achashverosh and Mordechai and Esther. The way he sums it up is the Megillah is a book about midos. Or, stereotypically, he says the Megillah is a Musar Sefer. And, in fact, he makes a point, which when you think about it is very compelling. There's almost no book in Tanakh that describes in such detail the personalities. You know, I'm sure Paro, there's a lot that could have been said about Paro, there's a lot that could have been said about a lot of people, and by the same token, the tzaddikim, the righteous people in Tanakh, we really aren't given, it's not like literature, we're not given a whole description of their personality. We have to piece it together from Midrashim and from what they did. But here, everything in the Megillah is in these extreme terms. The Megillah starts off, in fact, I'm going to jump around a little bit. If you look at the first full paragraph on page Ayin Zion, he's making this point. He says, Kishinadaftef and Megillah Zuka Seder, when we page through, Nadaftef means to go page by page through this Megillah. It's the first full paragraph on page Ayin Zion. So he quotes a little bit. Bayomim Ahim Kesheves, in those days when Achashverosh was sitting on his throne. Bahar Oso es Osher Kavod, etc. When he was showing off his great wealth and his glory. Says the Mashgiach, Hine Vadai Shekavanasu Zu Shalachashverosh. It is certain that this intention of Achashverosh was not so prominent. In other words, the Megillah starts off by saying, when he was showing off how rich and honored he was, says Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz, he didn't put up a sign that says, I want to have a party to show off how rich I am. That's the Megillah summing it up. As all the books of Tanakh do, they cut past the fluff and get right down to the core. The point is, he was a show-off. He probably had other reasons. He writes in the third line, Vada shekola pakuda shenitnu odos mishtazeh. Certainly all of the edicts that were given about this party, hayuksuvim behem sibos v'tamim shonu. There must have been other reasons. The king wants to have a party. He was celebrating this. He was celebrating that. He wants to be benevolent. None of them said he wants to show off. But the Megillah just says, when Achashverosh was showing off, his real intention was hidden. It might not have been recorded in some of the papers. However, the Torah's perspective on everything is to cut right to the core of it. Without the outer cloak. Malchus Achashverosh nikres Malchus Chonev. In the Medrash, Achashverosh's kingship is called that of a chonef. A chonef we commonly translate as a flatterer, but it means anybody who does things just to impress others. A person has no real values. It's a prohibition in the Torah, l'sachnifu es ha'aretz. Chanupa is viewed as a very negative midah, a very negative trait. And Achashverosh is described as the ultimate chonef. He kills his wife to please his advisors. Eventually he kills his advisor to please his wife. He's doing all kinds of things because he has different people he has to impress. He has no position of his own. Achashverosh has no real stance of his own. Everything is just for others. Right, I'm skipping a little bit, but that's what he sums up there. Says a line or two later, he says, Tochen kol zehu tzir mimidos. This is a description of midos. And what kind of midos? Bad ones. We move a little further in the Megillah. Gidal ha-melech Achashverosh es Haman v'gomer. He elevated Haman. V'chol avdei ha-melech and all the servants korim mishtachavim l'Haman. Everybody's bowing down to him. But what happens in Mordechai lo yichav lo yishtachav? One little yidl, Mordechai won't bow. Vayar Haman, Haman sees. Vayimolei Haman cheman. He's filled with wrath. Says the Mashkiach, hareza t'muna mehashchosos ha-midos. This is a depiction of the most corrupted midos. Gaiva, arrogance, kaas, anger. What does it say afterward? Vayivez beinev l'shloach yad b'mordechai levado. He rejected in his eyes to send his hand against Mordechai alone, etc. Vayivakesh haman l'hashmid es kol ha-yehudim. He wanted to wipe out all the Jews. I mean, this is off the charts. Commentary of the Mashgiach. Hashchasa v'achzarias mavhila. Incredible corruption and cruelty. It's astounding. L'hashmid am shalem, to wipe out an entire nation. Taf v'nashim, children and women. B'shvil pegias kavod shel yachid, because of an individual's stepping on the toes of his honor. What happens further? Yisapek haman, he holds back. Wow, tremendous midos there. Haman's able to hold on for a second. And he goes home. I mean, it's unbelievable. He goes home and has to tell his wife and family about all of his honor and his wealth and how big his family is and how the king elevated him. I mean, this is a book in Tanakh describing all of this, which again, I'm sure he did it in more couch terms. He weaved it into his narrative there. But Mikol Zeh Boletus Hagayv, the arrogance is so prominent. And then what? He says himself, it's all not worth anything to me. So now the Mashkiach writes sarcastically, how can his life be sweeter? With all that he has, his life is just not worth living if Mordechai won't bow down. Even his family has no consolation when he has such tzaros. He's got such tzaros, the Jew won't bow down. I mean, the midos we're describing here are just unbelievable. And then I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but then also the advice of his advisors, make a high tree and you'll hang Mordechai upon it, says the Mashgiach. Nora hadavar ech shesidrus ha'inyan ba'adishus kol kach gadol. How they set up this, adishus means with callousness, how they could present this suggestion with such callousness, as if we're not talking about the life of a person. Oh, you're so upset? Make a high gallows, then you'll be able to be happy. Then you'll be able to go to the party happy. Mordechai is interfering with your joy in life. Make a high gallows, hang him, it's the perfect remedy. Then you'll be able to be happy again and enjoy the party. And then when he shows up at the king's house at night, right, what should be done for a person the king wants to honor? And Haman says, I mean, this is probably the most laughable part of the whole Megillah. Haman says, and who else would he want to honor except me? Okay, says the Mashgiach, Tekef Tal HaKol Ba'atzmo. He immediately attributed the whole thing to himself. And also, you see what he wanted for himself. He should bring royal garments and the king's horse. Last four lines of that paragraph. V'chol asher lo ayin zaku brura. Anybody who has a pure and clear eye, tzir zeh harei ba'enuv kamachse schok v'tatum. The whole thing looks like a joke. It looks like a caricature. V'hu ba'emes tzir chai mikavad hamaduma. But the truth is, this is a living portrayal of what Kavod HaMaduma means imagined honor. People who pursue honor, they need artificial honor. Rabbeinu Yonah writes in Pirkei Avos that honor is really a false pursuit. Because if a person is truly honorable, then nothing you add gives him any more honor. And if he's not honorable, then anything he artificially does to bring honor to himself is not real anyway. So those who pursue honor, it's a vain pursuit. It says the Mashgiach, that's what the whole Megillah is depicting. This is where the pursuit of artificial honor, the pursuit of false honor brings a person. Bektzara, in short, ein mesuperkan odos Haman v'Achashverosh b'tor pratim. The Megillah is not talking about Haman and Achashverosh in the role of individuals. Elahu t'muna mimidas ra'os. It's a depiction of bad midas. Now, what he has set up earlier, what he set up earlier in this maimer is that the whole notion of anti-Semitism is a secret of the universe. It's a secret in the universe. It defies logic. If you'll recall from what we read last time, if you look in history, every problem that the world addresses, eventually they move past. It takes a few years, a few decades, but people move past it. They move on. There were things that were a big issue historically, but then the world, they either go this way or that way, and they move on, move past it. You don't keep addressing the same old issue as if it's a new issue. But the question of the Jews, it keeps renewing itself as if the Jews are a new nation, a new people. And this, now I'm jumping back to where we really left off last time, on the previous page, on page Ayin Vav. In the middle of the page, he writes, Hamisbonin b'divrei HaRamban v'Parshas Shmos. If somebody would look at the Ramban, the Nachmani's commentary to Parshas Shmos, the Pasuk Hava Neschakma, where Pyro says to his people, let's outsmart them. Nidmelo ki'ilu kare iton hayotzel arbi amenu ela. You would think you're reading a newspaper from today. Okay, so he's talking in the 1930s. He said, you'd think you're reading a newspaper from today. What does it say there? The Ramban says, Paro could not have just made a decree, let's destroy the Jews. It would not have gone over. Not internally, not externally. It would not have gone over. This is the nation that was invited here by the original Paro, the nation whose Sion, Yosef had saved them. He has a hatred for the Jews, this Paro, but he can't come out and say, let's destroy them. The Ramban writes explicitly, so what did he do? There were no official laws, but he just got the word out that if you give the Jews a hard time and they call the police, they're not going to get any support. If I think he summarizes it, yeah. Gamba Mitzrayim, how you ma'amidin ladin Mitzri haratzeach yelad Yehudi. In Mitzrayim also, they would bring to din, to judgment, a Mitzri who killed a Yehudi. El shetamid lo hayunim tzayim edim al haratzeach, but they could never find witnesses. V'hay haratzeach yotze lachavshim mechose berurim. He goes off because there's no, sorry, we don't have sufficient evidence. Says Rav Yeruchim Lavovitz, v'mamish kamo bezmanein b'mei apros b'rusi v'chadoma. This is like in the pogroms in Russia and so on. So the Ramban is just talking about how it went on in Mitzrayim. The point that Rav Yeruchim is trying to bring out is Mitkufa Shibud Mitzrayim Kvar Avir Yosem Yigimah Alafim Shana. We're talking 3,000 years later. Uvechol Zeh Kol HaKosav V'Nimtza Lanu Mitkufa Hi. Everything that's written and everything that we have from the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition. Ko Chadosh Ki'ilu Haviru Leinenu Es Tkufa Seinu Anu. It's so fresh, it's as if we're reading about our time. Tzir Chai Midoreinu Zeh. It's a living example of our generation. So what he means is that that brings out a question. There's a problem here. There's something that's inexplicable. It seems supernatural. And in fact, he says it is. So the next paragraph, back in Ayin Vav, last full paragraph on the page, Hamisbonin Heitiv Yireh, one who contemplates the matter carefully. By the way, in the old Svarim, they didn't have control B for bold. So when they wanted to make something highlighted, you skip a space when you're typing. Letter, space, letter, space, letter, space. So whenever in these notes you see words that are spaced out more, it means he's trying to emphasize. So this is something that's being emphasized. One who contemplates carefully will see. Shekol inyan oyvei ha-yehudim, the whole concept of haters, enemies of the Jews, who sowed. Sowed means it's a secret, means it's a deep concept. Sinas ha-umos la-yehudim, who also sowed, shall sinas haral ha-tov. The hatred that you find among nations toward the Jews is the same secret, the same deep concept of the hatred of evil to good. Ezel Uma Zeh Osa Elokim, famous pasuk in Koheles, in the book of Ecclesiastes, that says Hashem, it's not actually what it means in context, but it's what it's always quoted to mean from Chazal, Hashem made everything in balance. Zeh Uma Zeh, one force opposite another. If there's good, there's evil. When there's good, there's necessarily evil. And similarly, now, if you read this mimer, I have to give a little disclaimer. In the circumstance that they find themselves, he's almost using the word nations and evil synonymously. Don't want anybody to go out of here and say that everybody in the world is evil, but when he's writing in the period of time that he's writing in, probably especially with whom they were surrounded by, he wasn't so concerned with the good people out there too. But for our purposes, what he means, there's certainly plenty of evil in the world in our time as well. There's good too. But when he's talking about umos, he means those who are haters and those who are proponents of evil. So when there are v'chen k'shiyeshnam Yehudim, when there are Jews, muchrach shiyu oyvei ha-Yehudim, there have to be enemies of Jews. In fact, by the way, we're not going to get to it now, but he continued, usually these mamarim, one leads to the next, leads to the next. The whole theme that he's going to bring out of this going forward after Purim is, what all this should tell us is that we are supposed to be the symbol of the ultimate good. The Jew, by definition, is supposed to be so good and supposed to be such a paradigm of midos that if we are not so, it means we're so far afield of what we're supposed to be. So that's a corollary of this. If we can say that whatever hatred and evil there is in the world is supposed to be the antithesis of the Jews, that's a strong mussar to us as to what we are supposed to be. And in fact, the Midrashim say, and he quotes it, that therefore when we aren't that way, it's in an abnormal state of being. It's really not the way the Jewish people are supposed to be. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I wonder if the evil is caused by us going off, going away.
Yeah, there's a concept that God is particularly strict in responding to things that are a corruption of the way things are supposed to be. In other words, there's one thing, somebody didn't do the right thing. There's another thing when it's a corruption of the setup. It's one thing if a Jew doesn't have error, it's another thing if we are corrupting the very role we're supposed to play, which is a concept Swarm talk about. In any event, that's where he's going with all of this. But the concept of hatred toward the chosen nation is a zel umaseh. It's the hatred of ra to tov. He writes in brackets, the Kamosha b'chol dar v'dar yeshnam lamed vav tzadikim. There's a famous gemara in Sukkah, based on a pasuk in, I think, the Navi Yeshaya, Ashrei ha-machakim lo, fortunate are those who yearn and wait for him, but lo is also lamed vav, 36. That's the famous concept that there are always 36 tzadikim, righteous people. The gemara doesn't actually talk about them being hidden. Chassidish Svarim talk about that there's actually a concept of them being hidden tzadikim, and they uncover a little bit more of what this idea of the 36 tzaddikim, but it's an esoteric teaching mentioned in the Gemara and Sukkah. So he says it's the same idea, just like there are people out there, there are 30, let's assume as the teaching goes that they are hidden people. There are people out there, you never even heard of them, but they're so righteous, they're maintaining the world. Kimokain, Yeshnam Gam Oive HaYehudim B'chol Dar B'schum Masbek. So too, if there's a balance, there's also tremendous evil out there in sufficient amount. V'chazal Gilu Lanu, and our sages revealed for us Mekorish El Sinazu, the source of this hatred. This is a famous teaching of Chazal also. Lama Nikra Shmo Sinai. So the mountain on which the Torah is given is called Sinai. So this is a drasha, but the word Sinai is related to the word Sina, hatred. So Chazal say, Shemisham Yarda Sina Li Yisrael. From there came down hatred to the Jewish nation. What does that mean? The chosenness and the special role and the moral barometer that the Jewish people therefore brought to the world, and the goodness that they brought to the world and are supposed to maintain in the world, also create. If Har Sinai brought down immeasurable goodness to the world, it also created a tremendous negative force that's against that goodness. So Har Sinai, one of the drushas, one of the deeper homiletic reasons for that name is because it brought with it hatred. Kishakiblu Yisrael HaTorah, when the Jewish people received the Torah, v'hishtarish bekerav haKla Yisrael, kol sod hatov, and it was therefore rooted within Kla Yisrael, all of the deep concepts of good, ba'osa shah yarda sinu liYisrael. That time, so hatred also came down. Evil doesn't like good. What he says in the next paragraph is that therefore, what the Jewish people are supposed to be is the ultimate symbol of good. And then when you see hatred to it, that's usually emanating from the exact opposite, which is bad. So yeah, again, I already jumped ahead of this, but he says, that's why the Megillah is really a depiction of Midos. Now that we've depicted Achashverosh, he's the ultimate Chonef. No values, just make everyone happy, and that's why he's wishy-washy, he's all over the place. In fact, Chazal make a drush right at the beginning of the Megillah. How does the Megillah start? Vayhi bimei Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh. It wasn't the days of Achashverosh, he is Achashverosh. That verse, it catches your attention. And it wasn't the days of so-and-so, who was so-and-so. It almost sounds like he's two people. Why? So Chazal say, Achashverosh, who killed his wife because of his advisors, Achashverosh, who killed his advisors because of his wife. Achashverosh, who did this, Achashverosh, he's, in today's jargon, say flip-flopping. He's all over the place, so much so that you almost have to, oh, it's the same guy? Okay, good, because when I read his story, I can't figure out that it's the same guy. He's all over the place. So we have his Midos, we have Haman, who's the ultimate arrogant, honor-crazed, callous, murderous, and you have such lengthy depictions of these, like almost like in no other book of Tanakh. Now jump ahead to the bottom paragraph on Ayin Zion. See if Purim is the time of being jumping back and forth. So I'm jumping all over here, but I hope it's clear anyway. Lu'umaseh, but it keeps you awake. Bottom of Ayin Zion. Lu'umaseh, opposite this, mitzayeres lanu haMegillah tipusei Mordechai veEsther. The Megillah presents for us tipus, the word type, I think it's from tipuse, it means types, it means like a specimen, a prototype of Mordechai and Esther. So Gam Khan, here too, Eina Meduber B'Shivchei Esther and Mordechai B'Tar Prat. It's not talking about Mordechai and Esther as individuals, although it is, the Megillah is true in its plainest meaning too, but the reason why it's so important is because this is a prototype of positive midos. Esther is every Bas Yisrael, right? Everybody likes to dress up as Esther. Esther is everybody. Mordechai is everybody. Rather, it's a depiction of the characteristic and the midos of Abbas Yisrael. Lohi gida Esther es amav es molarita. Okay, Esther wouldn't say what nation she's from and where, you know, her birthplace, even though she is actually descended from royalty. Lo ratzasa shetisparsem v'malchus Achashverosh ha'adira b'shaita. Here's the Achashverosh kingdom, 127 provinces. And she has a chance to break in there and to have honor. She doesn't want it. Zehu mi midos haklai Yisrael. She's not interested in the added honor that would come if she would, in fact, divulge who she comes from. The Medrash says, he doesn't quote it, but there's a certain sense of hiddenness, of tznius, Esther comes from Rachel, who knew what was happening with her and Leah, and nevertheless didn't divulge, hey, I'm really the one who's supposed to be marrying Yaakov, not my sister. She keeps it quiet. Shaul, later, who's also descended, and who was an ancestor of Esther. Shaul, when he's told that he is going to be king, and then his uncle asked him, what was that all about? He says, Shmuel told me where the donkeys are. He doesn't mention, the pasuk says, "Vesdvar hamalucha lo higa," but he didn't mention the part that you're going to be king. Like that part he didn't, wasn't important enough to the story. These are people who have a mida of not divulging, of keeping things bitsnias, keeping things quiet and humble. Esther also has no interest in all of the grandeur and the glory. It's just basically the exact opposite of everything that we see about Haman. Bottom line there, Gamba Yosef, also with Yosef Matzinu, we find the same trait. Here's also a Jew, just like Esther is a Jewess who finds her way in the kingdom, in the palace. Yosef earlier is somebody who finds himself in the palace. Shehizir Lecha, what do we find about him? He exhorted his brother, Sheyatzigu Atzmam, turning the page to Ayin Chesna, Lifnei Para Bator Anshe Mikne. And here's an outsider who made his way into the palace. You'd think he wanted to do everything to promote his honor and dignity. He tells his brothers, oh, make sure you tell them that you're shepherds, which was anathema in Egypt. So he pushed them away and settled them in Goshen. Uvada, he says, Shabbatar Mishnah Lamelech, certainly in the role of the second, the viceroy of Egypt, the second to the king, it would have been much more fitting and honorable for him if he would have had his brothers something honorable in the kingdom. Yeah.
Yeah, but doesn't Mordechai tell Esther that she should have, this is the reason she needed to come out? So he chastises her for keeping back seat to some extent.
Well, when he's afraid that she won't intervene
right.
And do what she has to do, he says, what do you think you're here for? Right. But it's not really for the honor.
It's not the honor. It's the action.
Right, okay, so to intervene, this is the hand of God, Mordechai and Esther eventually see the whole thing, that this is all Hashem's hand. This is what you have to do. You're here to intervene. But that's in terms of the action, but in terms of the honor, you have like one picture against the backdrop of Haman with all of his wanting for honor, and then Esther, even among the other girls who are all trying to put their best foot forward in this pageant, she's not interested. Couldn't care less. No interest whatsoever.
But the honor came with the recognition in his heart, because she had to act. There was honor coming to her instead of taking a backseat and doing something else. That was what she did. So there must be some.
I'm not sure. I don't understand.
She was the one who acted in it, and she didn't do it in a convoluted way. She did it because it was her time to do it. But with that came honor.
Yeah, but the honor is only incidental. She has no personal interest. You'd think, once I'm getting a prominent position, historically there have been people who were in a role to help the Jewish people, but sometimes the honor, the position they got a little bit to their head. You have to realize she's being given this great position in the world at the time, and Megillah depicts for us that she's just, except for the functionality of it, which Mordechai draws home for, you have to put your life at risk to do this. Other than that, she has no interest in it whatsoever. So again, in this parenthetic remark, he says how Yosef would have done a lot better if his brothers wouldn't have been shepherds, particularly shepherds, which was despised in Egypt. So now in the fourth line there in Ayin Ches, Kihine, for behold, Lu hayach HaShverish Yodea Motzah Shalas HaShverish would have known where she came from. She bas Malachim, that she's a princess. Vadai Shagam Zeh HaYachal Asayeh LeTovasa Shedibach LeMalka. Put that down on your resume, it would help her chances. But Mordechai told her, don't tell. And then Ubahagia Tar Esther, when it came to Esther's turn, Lo Viksha Davar. Miguel uses those words. She didn't ask for anything. Says the Mashkiach, says Rabbi Ruchim Levavitz, Lo Viksha Davar. Those words, she didn't ask for anything. Zehu Kav Ha'over B'chol Chayeha Shel Esther. That's the line, that's the thread that runs through the whole life of Esther. Temuna machayeh shel bas Yisrael, kol chayeh hayu lo biksha davar. Her whole life was, she didn't expect anything. Ultimately, arrogance comes from the notion that, they say in Yiddish, it's kumtmir, it's coming to me. Esther's whole definition is she doesn't expect anything. Lo biksha davar, she doesn't expect anything. Biktzara, in short, tmuna, a picture shona min hakotze el hakotze, that is different from one extreme to the other, mitmuna hakademis, from the previous one, tzir shel midos tovos v'nelos. It's a depiction of the highest midos. So he says in the next paragraph, al tipuse hamegila tzarech lahabit ka'al haklal. You have to look at the prototypes, the specimens in the Megillah, like you look at a general rule. The tipuse hamegila dunim al haklal kula. They're really talking about the klal. Really, every Jew has the potential for those midos. That's the way we're supposed to look at ourselves. He writes in parentheses, chokrei atikos dunim al matzav kufos hakanmonis mipratim hachiktanim. People, we would say historical analysts, chokrei atikos means those who analyze things about the past, ancient things, judge a whole circumstance about an era from the smallest details, right? Archaeologists are able to figure out that, you know, they must have used this for this, therefore their lifestyle must have been like this, it must have been like that, and the truth is it's a true science. God set up the world in just about everything, from the smallest specimen, you know, from a cell, you can tell what's doing with a person. From the small things, you can tell the nature of big things. So Esther is an individual, but she's really the story or the description of what we are supposed to be. She's every Bas Yisrael. V'cheinu be'emes poshut. And the truth is, it's obvious that way. Ha'prat hu ha'ro nechon al ha'klal. The specific, the individual, is a correct indication about the broader general rule. U'kesha'adam lomei divrei chazal. And he tells us a general rule here. When a person studies the words, Chazal stands for Chachameinu Zichron Levracha, the writings of our sages, Yilmud Gam Kein Al Derech Zeh. He should also study in this way. Uma Shemuva B'Devreim Odos Yechidim, what is cited in their words about individuals, Aleinu Ladun Mizal Aklal. You're supposed to judge from that about the general. For example, he gives a very good example, Kishe Amru Ki Alecha Haragnu Kol Hayom, Zo Isha Veshiva Baneha, the famous story of, these are from the stories we tell Tisha B'Av time, the Gemara is in the middle of Maseches Gittin there, but a woman and her seven sons, she forfeited all of them and then lost her own life. So there's a pasuk, Ki Alecha Ragnu Kol Yom, every day we forfeit our lives for you, Hashem. So the Gemara says, that refers to the woman and her seven sons. So what if, and Chazal do this frequently, they'll say, this pasuk refers to that incident. This pasuk refers to that person. This pasuk is Avraham Avinu. This pasuk, they don't mean him particularly or her particularly. They mean that is the paradigm that this pasuk is talking about. That person lived up to it. So whenever you see in the writings of our sages, that pasuk refers to him or her, they mean him or her as the paradigm of what we all should be. It's a prat, a specific that's supposed to reveal something about the klal. It doesn't mean they were unique in their generation. He's saying that was a specimen of what many people had, Klal Yisrael in general had. So do we see in the Torah, you look at the generation of the wilderness, the Jews in the desert. So we read the Chumash and we see all the instances in which they complain they did something wrong, and we say, oh, it was very bad. But the truth is, it's the opposite. Those were the few sins. From all of the myriads of the Jewish people, you don't find a sin except for the few that are enumerated. That's above anything we can fathom. It gives a few examples of this. A person who understands man's current situation, that his sins are abundant like grains of sand, because who cannot fathom such awesome loftiness. Describing the Jewish people at the time of the temple, Amr Chazal, lo lon odam b'Yerushalayim ubiyado oven. Person didn't stay overnight in Jerusalem and have a sin on his hand, meaning he was taken care of. He would offer a karban. All sins were remedied. He says this is all beyond what we can understand. And at the end of the paragraph, he says, "V'zohi t'muna chaya mehaklal Yisrael." That ultimately is supposed to be a living picture where the Jewish people are supposed to be. Next paragraph. V'chein ha-mizbonin b'chol mitzvos ha-Torah. It says if you really contemplate the mitzvos in the Torah, this is such a powerful point. For example, okay, it says in the book of Dvarim, Karva shnas ha-sheva shnas ha-shmita. The sabbatical year is coming, the shmita year is coming. And you have like a stingy eye toward your brother who's poor, etc. Don't do that. Nasan titen lo. You should get, lend him money. Velo yera levavcha besitcha lo. And let your eye not be bad, which is a way of saying to feel stingy, to feel upset about it. When you give to him, don't do it even with a bit of a stingy eye. So who was that pasuk said to? The entirety of the Jewish nation. Azhara al kol echad mi Yisrael. This is a negative commandment, a warning to all of the Jewish people. Shekeshe mevakshem imenu halva. When somebody asks for a loan, ba'eis sheshnas ha-shmita mashmesh lavo. When the Shemitah year is coming. That was a year when you couldn't work the land, income was a lot less, you couldn't do, you know, industrial farming and so on. The sakonas avdan mamono. And he's in danger of losing his money. Afal PK, nevertheless, lo rak shelo yimna milahalvos. Not only should he not hold back from lending, elo lo yera levavcha besitchalo. This is not a medrash. This is not an idea presented in a Musar Sefer. This is a pasuk. Your heart. You shouldn't have a bad heart. You shouldn't feel bad about it. You shouldn't have any hesitations when you give him the money. And that's a mitzvah on all, that's the level of midos that we're all held to. And the Shemitah, I mean, it's been historically, it's always been a great challenge. You know, the history of the Jews in the land of Israel over the last 100+ years, it's been it was actually a great source of debate. So that's a fascinating thing. On the one hand, we were sent into Golos because of failure to observe Shemitah. Some Gedolei Yisrael felt, therefore, we have to keep Shemitah with all of the greatest stringencies because that's going to bring the redemption. And when Jews were resettling the land of Israel at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, and it was very, very difficult, some Gedolei Yisrael felt, we cannot find any halachic leniencies with Shemitah because we're going to bring the redemption by keeping it to a T without any leniencies. Others felt that the mitzvah of striving and being Moser Nefesh to resettle in the land of Israel is what's going to help bring the redemption. And if Shemitah is going to make it impossible, then we have to try to find leniencies to make it possible. So you had a very big debate. Should we seek leniencies? Should we not? This was going on in the early years of the 1900s. But in any event, Shemitah historically was always difficult. And the Torah is saying when a person foresees all those difficulties coming, not only should he have a mitzvah to lend, but not to even feel stingy about it. It's not only that he can't take out his grievance on someone else, but the pasuk says in Parshas Kedoshim, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. In fact, according to the Rambam, that prohibition means specifically when it's only in the heart. If he acts upon it, if he does something not nice or says something not nice, according to the Rambam, then he's violating other prohibitions. But this prohibition is specifically when it's in his heart. I mean, it's one thing to say don't do something not nice, but to not have any hard feelings in the heart. Shafilo apshutim shabi yisroel. Even the simplest Jews, muzharim, are commanded. Shali yimatze behem shemetz shal kina sinna v'natir balei. There shouldn't be a vestige of jealousy, hatred, bearing a grudge in the heart. Vaz haros elu hushrishu be'emes bekerav haklal Yisrael v'nesu mitchunosem ha'atzmios. These mitzvos are inculcated within klal Yisrael and are part of their inherent characteristics. Sharei amru chazal, as our sages say, why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed, the second temple where they were busy studying Torah and doing mitzvos and they were even doing chesed, why was it destroyed? Because of sinas chinam. Because of unwarranted hatred. So what he means by that is this is so part and parcel of what the Jews are supposed to be, that when we're not, it's not viewed as some minor avera, it's viewed as the Jews not living up to their very inherent state of being, their midos. So he ends up saying, in short, Biktsara mahusa shala klayiswa humidasto. The mahus, the word ma means what? Mahus means the whatness, the essence, the very being of the Jewish people is supposed to be good midos. This is depressing because we're not at this state of being. But he quotes the famous pasuk in Shir HaShirim that if we look darkened, it's artificial. If we look sullied, it's not really the way we're supposed to be. The Jewish people are supposed to be paragons of good midos. I'll just read to you one paragraph. He writes on page I in Test, the first full paragraph there. I mean, this is amazing. Hanoladim b'doreinu zeh. Again, he's talking the 1930s. Those who are born in our generation, umotzim haklal Yisrael kamoshu at, and find the Jewish people the way they are now, yuchlu lachshov, could think, shekein haya mikadmas tanada. That's the way it was earlier. Aval anoshim boyim bayamim, but older people, shiro gamas hador ha'avrim lefnei yovel shanam, who saw the world 50 years ago, yecholim lehoid, can testify, shehem ro'u adayin esaklal Yisrael b'tefarto, that they saw the Jewish people in its glory. I mean, you have to realize that we today, we talk about the generation that he was living in. Oh, look, we talk about it as the great generation of the Rosh Yeshiva. This is a world when the Chafetz Chaim is alive. This is where you have people like this, Rabbi Rucham Levavitz and other Gedolei Yisrael. We glorify and talk about how great his generation is. And he's saying, oh, people who are alive today, think of this is what the Jewish people looked like. Those of us who are a little older, we remember the Jewish people 50 years ago. We saw it in its glory. Bayama Mahami writes, Hayu motzim b'chol ayara v'ayara, you could find in little villages and little hamlets, Yireim u'shleimim ka Chafetz Chaim. You could find Chafetz Chaims all over the place. And he says, V'ein kavan aseinu l'hafchis chas v'shom be'erko shal Chafetz Chaim. And I don't mean in any way to minimize the greatness of the Chafetz Chaim. Vaday shagam b'doros haheim haya ishmof, it's certain that even those in that time, years ago, he would be considered a wonder. Elosh his karnu b'tor samal u'mofis me'ava u'midus shanoshim ka'elu haya mitzuyim larov, that such people were found in abundance. I mean, aside from righteousness, which is very hard for us to quantify, I mean, just in scholarship, if you study Svarim, you have to thank God today Torah is burgeoning and there's a lot of good scholarship and so on and so forth. But if you look at the abundance of writing going back a couple centuries of people from all over the place and the number of Chachmei Yisrael, I mean, you see it to be so. Again, righteousness, I can't quantify, but I can take people's testimony to it. But he says, Chasidim v'anshei Maisa, they were righteous people. For some of Shainim, some famous, some not. Hayu mitzuyim la'alafim l'ravavos, were found in thousands and myriads. Hakadusha v'atahara haisa nikaris b'kol chayim, that you could see holiness and purity in all of their lives. And we're far from that. They tell a story in the early years in America that some rav from Europe came over to America and he met a rabbi in America who was taking him around. They were in a cab and he pointed to a certain Jew and he said, that's the Chafetz Chaim of America. And the Rav responded, and I'm the Chafetz Chaim of the taxi cab. In other words, like, it depends what you're, you know. But look, the Jewish people have been through a lot, and it's hard to rebuild. But he's saying this is what we saw in great abundance. And we have to realize that that's supposed to be our natural state of being. So what should pull out of the Megillah, among all the other messages, is its depiction of Ra and Tov. There is terrible evil in the world, but there's also the potential for tremendous good in the world, and the Jewish people are expected. We have certain privileges, but that means certain expectations and responsibilities, and to bring us back to the state we're supposed to be, as aware we are of Arur Haman in the world, we have to be aware of Baruch Mordechai in the world. I'll skip down to the bottom paragraph because just about out of time. He says that when his Rebbe, I believe he means the Altar of Kelm here, Rav Simcha Zisel Ziv, who was the sage of Kelm, when he passed away, he calls here Hagrimi Petterberg, that's Rav Yitzchak of St. Petersburg, that's Rav Yitzchak Blazer of St. Petersburg, Rav Yitzchak Petterberger, said a eulogy, and he said that in medicine, there's two skills. One is the diagnosis, and the other is the cure. And he was talking about how the altar of Kelm in Musar was able to do both. He was able to diagnose and chart out the cure. He says, we're lacking a lot of the latter skill. Now, the great Bali Musar could not only figure out what the problem is, what's wrong in the person's character, but also how to fix it. We're missing a lot of that. But, and you don't have this anymore, going on to the next page, he says, but we have certain things we know just because the Torah tells us. And I'll just end. He has a vart here from the Vilna Gaon. On the one hand, we have a pasuk that says, Kel Nekamos Hashem. Nekama, which is vengeance, at God's level, is great. It's put between his two names. Kel Nekamos Hashem. Kel and Hashem, two names of God. Taking Hashem, not us, but Hashem taking revenge from evil is a great thing. So on the one hand, vengeance is great because it's between the two names of Hashem. On the other hand, we have another pasuk that says, Kel Deos Hashem. So Nekama, vengeance, is put between the two names of Hashem. Deos, is Das, is put between the two names of Hashem. The Vilna Gaon like makes a connection. He says, when you knock out the Das, you also knock out the Nekama. Whatever sense of jealousy and desire to take revenge and so on is within us, if you take out our Das, it goes away. One of the avodas of Purim, the idea that Purim is ad lo yada, it's sort of there's almost a silliness, and we take out the das. He drinks more wine than he's used to, and his das is gone. It breaks down the barriers between people. It takes away the sense of nekama. He says Purim is a one-day special opportunity to try to get us back to, as we read last time, a lot of the tension between people. You send your shalach manas, you give your matanas lo yana, it's all goodness. The revelry is in such a way where we just distract ourselves from anything that makes us a stickler, makes us hold people to accountable for things they've done in the past. It's a big dose of goodness in the world, and that ultimately is what the Jewish people are meant to be. And as we learned last time, ultimately the goal is the goodness should be so great that it undoes all evil, internally and externally, until we reach the level we don't know the difference between Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai, because there is no more Aruch Haman, as we learned last time. Ultimately, the Yetzer Hara is meant to be converted to the Yetzer Tov. All forces of evil are meant to turn around for the forces of good. That's what's supposed to happen ultimately, and Purim is a microcosm of that. Halavai, we tap into the special powers of Purim and bring out some of that. Bezos Hashem, wish everybody a Freilich and Purim and a good rest of the week. Okay.
Cool. Yeah.